Before we get started with today's show, I wanted to tell you about another great ESPN podcast, the Woj Pod. How does 25-year-old two-time MVP Giannis Antetokounmpo get drafted 15th overall in the week draft class? Adrian Wojnarowski investigates the twists and turns that led to a franchise and league altering selection in 2013. A three-part series within the Woj Pod that tells this unique story, including interviews with individuals close to the process, as well as a one-on-one sit-down with Giannis himself. Check out the Woj Pod special, the Giannis Draft, now as well as the right time, wherever you get your podcasts. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the right time. My name is Bomani Jones. Thanks for listening wherever you get your podcasts. Rate us, review us, give us 5 stars. You only give us 4 stars. I'm inclined to believe you are a hater. Coming up on this episode of The Right Time, we're going to talk about what in the world happened in the NFL this weekend and how the Masters got all the flex in the world. Also, we'll continue our baseline series with Brian Windhorst of ESPN telling you about the prep to pro pipeline in basketball. But first, so Russell Westbrook popped up after spending a year in Houston. Remember, he went there to play with his homeboy, James Harden, right? They know each other back from the crib. They played at Oklahoma City. Like, they was ready to play together. Russell Westbrook did that for 1 year, looked around and was like, nah, I'm good on this, homie. Not really feeling it. A couple things with Westbrook, right? One, apparently he wants to be back in a situation where he's got the ball in his hands all the time, right? Classic Russell Westbrook stuff. I don't know if that's the best idea, but I can see why he thinks that could still work. He actually had a pretty good season, right? Did not play well in the bubble, come off COVID, had the injury. You know, I'm willing to cut him some slack on that. But the other part that I found to be interesting was he said that he felt like Houston had a culture that did not have the proper levels of accountability, which, I mean, you tell me if I'm wrong here, but that seemed like a shot at James Harden, right? Like a direct shot at James Harden. And I say that because everything about the culture in Houston was built around James Harden. Morey made that call early. Once he got Harden, he was like, okay, cool. This is our guy. We're going to build things around whatever it is that James Harden wants, what he likes. Well, who do you think we should go sign, James? Okay, cool. Well, we'll see if we can go ahead and do that. That's how the Rockets wound up making that ridiculous decision that one time to bring in Ty Lawson, when anybody could look at that and be like, oh, no, this isn't going to work at all. But that's what James wanted, and so they went with it. I don't really so much blame or judge Harden for that, because that's what happens with superstars in the NBA, right? Like, they have that level of flex. They are able to go in and get what they want, and those are the things that they wanted. And Russell Westbrook looked around at the house that James built and said, nope, this isn't going to work. Now, Gabe, did you read the story in The Athletic when this first came out?
Yes, I did.
So the thing that I found interesting in that story, which obviously had a lot coming from the Westbrook camp on things, right? Like, it seemed very clear. But one thing they pointed out was Westbrook wanted a culture more like Oklahoma City. And with the way they described the culture in Oklahoma City was that Westbrook had the authority to check people, basically. Be like, yo, you're not doing this. You're not doing this. But the story made it clear to point out, but Russell would always start with himself on these matters. That was how I knew. I was like, oh, okay, so this is coming straight from Russ. Because it's like, yo, don't get it wrong, Russ also holds himself accountable, but Russ is out here holding everybody else accountable. Now, what I found to be interesting about that is, Gabe, it don't seem like nothing really changed with Russell Westbrook over the years. Like, I'd be curious to know what exactly he holds himself accountable for and what the changes are after said accountability holding takes place.
What's interesting, though, is when you're talking about culture, and you're talking about culture with the Rockets and culture with the Thunder, you're talking about it through the prism of the players, right?
Right.
But think about the culture through the prism of the owner and of the GM.
Yeah.
Morey's like the anti-Presti, like going after just the stars. Presti's going after just the picks. Clay Bennett, the owner of the Thunder, is like shadow owner, like you never see from him or hear from him since they moved from Seattle. And then Fertitta, your man Fertitta, is out there on Front Street.
Yes. Yes, like they are very, very, very different teams and very different organizations, right? There's no way around that part. And I think that is a very good point. But let's get to where this got fun, which is Westbrook said he wanted out. And then after we hear that Westbrook wanted out because of the culture of accountability, which again, I say is all tied to James Harden, James Harden pops up and was like, yeah, I want to go too. And not only do I want to go, I want to go play for the Nets. I want to go play in Brooklyn with Kyrie and Kevin Durant. That is the worst idea I have ever heard, right? Now, it seems from what I've noticed on the tweets that a lot of you guys think this idea is a fantastic one because you want to see the whole thing burn down, right? And then there's another set of people who think that this is a fantastic idea, and they believe that it is a fantastic idea because they understandably look at it and see three players with that level of talent. And they say, you get those three guys, and then you go figure out how to make it work because the guys are just too talented for you to not go ahead and figure out how to make it work. And on its face, that does not seem terribly illogical. In reality, I can only assume that you are saying that having never watched any of these guys actually play basketball.
How about watching the Rockets themselves the last 2 years?
Right.
Kind of like a get stars at all cost, culture be damned.
Yeah, well, I think with the Rockets that Morey operated on the belief that the best way to win a championship, understandably, was to get two of the top 15 players in the league on your team, right? That makes sense. But let's go back and look at the last 10 champions, all right? The Mavericks in 2011 did not have two of the top 15 players in the league, okay? Those two with the Heat, they did. The Spurs in 2014, I'm not sure they had any of the top 15 players in the NBA on that team. The 2015 Warriors had one of the top 15 players in the NBA. The 2016 Cavs, maybe Kyrie was one of the top 15 players in the league at that point, but I think that's questionable, and the same with Kevin Love, right? Now, having Kevin Love and Kyrie Irving as year two and three is pretty damn impressive, but I'm not sure that was two of the top 15 players in the league. Those two with the Warriors after that, they definitely had two of the top 15 players in the league with Steph and Kevin Durant. There's no, you know, that's what that was. 2019 with the Raptors, they did not have two of the top 15 players in the NBA. And the Lakers this year, they just had two of the top 15 players in the NBA, but we weren't sure about them that whole way. They didn't have two of the top 15. They had two of probably the top five players in the NBA, and that's how they got that done. But my point being, I don't know if in this era of the NBA, it's as important to have two of the 10 or 15 best players in the NBA as it had been before. And having three of the top 15 players in the NBA, to me, that works if you have three of the top 15 players in the NBA, but their games are quite complementary. Like, the tricky thing for the Heat when they were trying to figure that out was that LeBron and Dwayne Wade did not really have complementary games. Part of the reason why it ultimately worked was because Chris Bosh had a game that could move into something that was a bit more complementary for the rest of the Heat, right? We had Chris Bosh out here. It was funny when he talked about what made him so frustrated was when he would finally get the ball in the post, they'd come double team him. When everybody else is in the post, they just get the ball all by themselves, right? But to me, it is much more important that you have the right fit on those top three players than simply just saying we're going to get the best three players that we can get at the top of the roster, and then we'll go figure everything else. Okay, so the three guys that we're talking about with this experiment that the Nets seem to be talking about, or that James Harden seems to want. Kyrie Irving needs the ball. James Harden needs the ball. Or at the very least, has operated for the last 3-4 years under a circumstance where he had the ball all the time. All right? And then there's Kevin Durant, who I don't care what they're saying these summer workouts or everything else look like. We don't have any idea what that's going to look like with Kevin Durant coming off of an Achilles tear. We're not sure. But either way it goes, Kevin Durant needs somebody to get him the ball. These two guys that we're talking about that need the ball, they don't need it to get it for other people. They just need the ball. Now, let's look at something else, specifically with the James Harden element of this. If Westbrook looked at the culture in Houston and was like, nah, there's not enough accountability here. I don't like the way that this feels, all right? Like, I don't think this is what it is. Now, keep in mind, there's a turnover going on over there, right? Daryl Morey is gone. Mike D'Antoni is gone. Steven Silas has come in as the head coach. I don't know what exactly Steven Silas is talking about, but whatever it is, James Harden looks at it and looks at the Rockets and says, our window is closed. It's time for me to get out of here. Now, do I know for certain that he would have said that if Morey was still there? I don't know, because Morey's one of those guys that you feel kind of confident will find a way to make it work, all right? Like, one thing that's interesting to me about the guys when they make these moves in free agencies and decide that they want to go team up with their partners, and I don't blame them for wanting to team up with their partners, but it seems to me that the move that you need to make is to team up with a front office. Like, you need to team up with a general manager. Like, if LeBron was making decisions from 2014 on strictly in terms of basketball, probably should stay with the Heat, right? And I say that because look at what Pat Riley managed to pull off with this team that they've got now that went to the finals in this last year. Like, Riley is one of these guys where you look at it and it's like, okay, well, we're going to find a way one way or another in order to get this done. That's not what LeBron did. LeBron went and saw that the Cavs had something right now because he needed to get these rings right now, and then went to an organization that was wobbly, right? Went to an organization that you are not in a position to trust. Harden repeatedly kept re-signing with the Rockets, not even becoming a free agent. Just re-signing to play with the Rockets, which you have to take as a measure of faith in Daryl Morey and what Morey could put together. So, okay, cool. Now he does not have that faith in the Rockets. Would you have that faith in the Nets?
No, but another like possibility for Harden in this whole deal is to join back up with Morey in Philly.
Well, yeah, see, that's why I'm a little surprised that that isn't the place that he wants to go, except it dawned on me why it is that he would want to go to the Nets. So who's the coach of the Nets?
Steve Nash.
Okay. But who's going to be the coach of the Nets this year?
One Mike D'Antoni.
Bingo. Bingo. That's the thing to me. Like, Nash is definitely going to be the coach, like the head coach, right? But I think I was talking to my man Vinny about this. The comparison he made is Mike D'Antoni will be to Nash what Rick Carlisle was to Larry Bird when he was with the Pacers. It'll be a setup that I think is similar to Golden State. For example, when Alvin Gentry came in and ran the offense and then Ron Adams ran the defense and then Steve Kerr was like the face of this. Like, I think that Nash is going to be the one calling the timeouts. Nash is going to be the one talking to these guys. He's going to be like the vision of whatever it is that they want to do. But Mike D'Antoni is not becoming an assistant coach on your team to not run the offense, right? That is why we know him. That is why he's here. That is what he does, right? This is what you get from Mike D'Antoni. What did we just see Mike D'Antoni do for years with his offense when it was built around James Harden? Just gave him the ball, right? What do you think Kyrie Irving is going to do under such a circumstance? He just going to give him the ball, right? Now, year after year, we would hear, Pablo used to always make this point when we did High Noon, that James Harden would go through these seasons and he would do everything and he would be obviously exhausted by the end of the year. And it would always come back around and the argument would be, well, James doesn't want to have to carry everything anymore. So let's bring somebody in to help James out with carrying the load. They brought Chris Paul in to help him with carrying the load. And James Harden still looked exactly the same as he had before. And then Chris Paul looked around and was like, nah, I don't want to do this. Okay. They bring in Russell Westbrook. In order to make it work with Westbrook, they had to stagger those dudes so much. Why'd they have to stagger those dudes so much? Because both of them had to have the ball in that way, right? Like, both of them had to command the rock. So how in the world is that idea supposed to work, right? Maybe Harden's thing is, these are my homeboys. You just played with your homeboy, and your homeboy didn't want no more parts of playing with you. Like, nothing about this, to me, seems like a good idea. And in spite of how much cats like this decide, well, I'm going to play with my homeboy, we ain't going to have no problem moving the ball. All those I'm going to play with my homeboy setups have eventually wound up with dudes having problem moving the ball, right? Think about, now, Kevin Durant didn't go to Golden State to play with his homeboys, but Kevin Durant went to go to Golden State to play that beautiful type of basketball, right? Like, where the ball just moved around, the ball finds energy, all of that stuff. And then what happened? The ball would find Kevin Durant, and Kevin Durant would be like, all right, cool, let me go out here and try to find buckets. Which, by the way, made perfect sense. I'm not judging him for that, right? Like, if you have Kevin Durant, sometimes the ball should stop with Kevin Durant so Kevin Durant can find a way to get a bucket, right? My point is, what he said he wanted turned into something different once the bullets started flying. And then you go back to doing what it is that you know and doing what it is that you've been doing. How do you think that's going to work with James Harden? How do you think that's going to work with Kyrie Irving, right? And this is before we even get to the point of talking about personalities. Like, how exactly are you going to put all this together? Schematically, how are you going to figure out a way to do this? So one thing I always find interesting about D'Antoni is he's the 7 seconds or less guy, right? Now, when he was coaching the Suns, they were basically running the fastest team in the league. When he was running the Rockets, they were basically running the slowest team in the league. But the pace was actually not that different. Like, you can go look it up with those Suns teams versus these Rockets teams. I did this a few years ago. I hadn't looked it up before I did this. But the pace was relatively similar with those teams. The game had kind of changed. But one reason that 7 seconds or less thing could work with the Suns was they really only had one guy on that team that was like, give him the ball and let him go get a bucket. And that was Stoudemire, right? Like, Nash had the ball or whatever, but Nash is out here shooting 11, 12 shots a game. Like, that wasn't really the game, like the need that he had. The Nets are talking about three guys who need to hold the ball in order to get it done. Like, do you think that Harden or Kyrie is going to turn himself basically into what we saw from Anthony Davis with the Lakers this year? Anthony Davis, like Kevin Love, became a catch-and-shoot guy playing with LeBron and Kyrie. Chris Bosh became a catch-and-shoot guy playing with LeBron and Dwayne Wade. Which of these guys going to turn into a catch-and-shoot guy? You going to turn Kevin Durant into a catch-and-shoot guy? James Harden is not built to be a catch-and-shoot guy. Kyrie Irving is not built to be a catch-and-shoot guy. And on top of that, these are three guys who are used to a team being theirs. Okay? Like, even though Kevin Durant and Kyrie came together, Kevin Durant did not come play this year. Okay? Kyrie was treating that like it was his own team. The Rockets have been James Harden's organization for 8 years. Kevin Durant went from Oklahoma City, really largely being his team. Russ was involved too, but it was largely being his team. And then went to Golden State, where it was not his team, but they had to treat him like it was his team. So whose team is it? You know? Like, do these cats have the friendship that Dwayne Wade and LeBron James had? Because I don't know if that LeBron and Wade thing could have worked if they did not have the friendship that they had. Right? Like, it never turned into real beef over there. It never turned into anything super awkward. And look, there were moments. Like, you have to go back and kind of look at them. But if you go back and look at Game 7 of the 2013 NBA Finals, where Dwayne Wade was taking all these shots in the first half, but the Heat were so much worse off for it because people had all these things to say about how Dwayne Wade wasn't getting it done. And then in the second half, it was like, dog, you're going to let LeBron do this so we can win a championship? And then it ultimately happened. But I think those two, with the relationship they have, they could make that work. Do these cats really have those that kind of relationship where they can go out here and figure this out in those times and it's three of them and as much as the Nets would have to give up in order to get him? It just doesn't make any sense to me.
I think the player response when they get these sorts of questions is like, oh, you know what? But we're friends. We'll figure it out. But there's a reason as to why you're asking these questions and why this is so important, why the fit is so important, and why the personality is so important. Because if it doesn't work, you just wasted like 3 to 5 years of your career.
Yep. Yep.
Shouldn't it be like more important that you're finding the right fit rather than just like playing with your friend? Because it's really fun to play with your friend, obviously, but he's not going to be your friend if it doesn't work out well.
Right. Here's my question. What qualifies as a good fit with James Harden?
I don't know, man. I don't think we've seen it. I feel like people keep wanting to like relive those Thunder years and be like, oh yeah, when Harden was the third option, you know, he can do that again.
Yeah, that's over. Right? Like, why do people act like that wasn't 8 years ago? You know what I'm saying? Like, that was 8 years ago. James Harden in part left because he didn't want to be nobody's third option. You know, and look, you can be a second option that is reasonably similar to being the first option on an NBA team. That can happen. But the gap between two and three in one of those circumstances is huge. Huge. There's no room to make sure three people eat. Like, maybe if that third person spends a lot of time out there by himself with the second unit, right? But part of why the idea of having those three guys only makes but so much sense is there's only but so much of a return on asset that you can get from a third option. Like, those three guys, how many points a game with those three playing together do we think the third option would wind up getting? Because it ain't going to be 25 points a game, right? It should be more like probably 18, 19.
I feel like that's what Bosh averaged when he was with the Heat, was like 17, 18.
Yeah, like that seems to be about where it would be. You think Kyrie Irving's here to score 18 points a game?
That's the funny thing. Yeah. I don't think any three of them want to be averaging 17 points.
No, No, and again, with Harden, I had some people try to make the argument to me that Harden was only doing that because it was D'Antoni's offense. Number one, look whose offense he's going to go play in now, right? And maybe D'Antoni will cook up something different, but go look at whose offense this, you know, this is that he's going to get into. But the other part is, if James Harden didn't want to play that way, they weren't going to play that way. Like, with all the clout that he had within that organization, they weren't forcing James Harden to be the king of ISO. They weren't forcing James Harden to take all of those shots, right? And clearly, they weren't forcing him to play that much defense. Now, look, Harden is not as bad a defender as he was, right? Like, we was putting out all the clips of him just absolutely not paying any attention on defense and everything else. He is not that guy anymore. He is a capable defender. You'll have the dorks will break out some advanced stats stuff on you with Harden. That's actually pretty impressive, but nobody's looking at James Harden to go shut it down, although the Oklahoma City Thunder didn't Harden make that big play at the end, like down there, you know, in the playoff series. But that's not where people are looking at James Harden. He's not going to be that guy. That's not how he's built to be. So who is this team going to guard? With those three guys out there, who's going to be your great wing defender? DeAndre Jordan's too old to be the guy to, like, man the paint. Who going to do it?
And they might be trading away potentially their best, like, interior defender in Jared Allen and a James Harden deal.
Right. Oh, this is a horrible idea. This is a horrible idea, but it will be entertaining, right? Absolutely. You know who's got to be feeling great about this, though? I feel like Steph Curry has to be feeling great about this. Think about this. Those three guys, they had a competition, right? These are three guys that could be very close to the front of championship teams. We eliminating three of them, right? All at one time. We eliminating three of them. Put them all together and watch it explode.
Yeah, for an experiment, eliminating three for one experiment, the possibility of being one.
Yes, like everybody else in the league is going to be like, oh, okay, yeah, that's cool. Hey, I'm with that. Like, this season's looking like it's going to be wild, man. And story number one is going to be a fire in Brooklyn.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
All right, guys, the Masters was this weekend. I understand that a lot of you are not really that big into golf, but, like, for me, the Masters is a different animal simply because there's so much going on with the Masters, right? So one thing I learned over the course of time that I didn't really, like, understand when I was younger, which is spring, like springtime, is really important to a lot of y'all. I grew up in the Sun Belt, okay? So springtime didn't really mean that much to us because it never really got that cold, right? And so I didn't realize how many things that were out there, like, signaled spring and what spring meant if you lived in one of these miserable cold places. Like, I remember when we moved to Houston, they had all these commercials about the Astros playing spring training, right? And there's just always this huge thing about spring training. And I never, like, understood why people thought, like, spring training mattered so much. They just going down there to practice, right? And so, like, people who are just always ready, pitchers and catchers, show up whatever date it is, you know? And what I came to understand gradually was that for them, this was a signal that the thaw is beginning. You know what I mean? Like gray skies are going to clear up. Like, that's what all this stuff was basically telling them. And it was just something I'd never really, really done the math on. And what is a serious signal of spring for a lot of people is the Masters, right? Like, just that event. And so, I ain't watch a whole lot of the Masters, but I'd watched it. Like, as an adult, I've watched it a lot more, but I didn't really watch it much when I was younger. But I totally got, like, what part of the appeal of the Masters was to people, as it was gray here on Thursday and Friday, and it was a little bit chilly. It was pretty damn miserable. Man, I turned on ESPN to the Masters, and it looked like the sunniest place on earth. The grass is perfectly green, everything else. And I'm like, oh, if this were in the spring, this is putting you up on game. I was like, oh, okay. Like, so this is a big thing about the Masters, and I get the appeal of it. And I may have talked about this on this podcast before, but if I haven't, Just think about this, man. Nobody got more flex than the Masters. Nobody in sports has the level of flex of the Masters. How much flex does the Masters have? CBS did not play football in the first half of a Sunday NFL slate because the Masters was on. Gabe, did you happen to watch College Game Day on Saturday from Augusta?
I saw the screenshots of the set.
Okay.
I didn't actually watch the broadcast there, did you?
I did not watch it from the beginning. I watched parts of it. And this I don't know. Did they have, what they call them, Big and Rich, whoever they are, the country rapping, you know, whatever. Did they start with that? Because when I turned on and it was game day at the Masters, it was the pianos. You know, they was not coming to your city. Whoever, I forget, I know my man Cowboy Troy is on there. But it was, I did not hear anything that implied that we was coming to your city. We were coming to your golf course, and we promise we will not make more noise than we have to, if that's okay with you. All right. Right? They were set up. They were out there. Like, the Masters is like, we ain't got time for all this damn noise. You know what I'm saying? They got the chairman of Augusta National sitting out there or whatever. And what they do with the Masters that is so amazing. Like, you do realize that Augusta National is a secret society, basically. Like, you'll know who the chairman is, but they won't tell you who the members are. We got no idea who is actually a member of Augusta National. But they put on a golf tournament that is like a part of American lore that everybody is all in on all the time. Is there anything else that is that public that is run by a secret society? Nothing. Like, secret societies are normally secret. Not this one. This secret society is like, come see how we get down. Come see how we live. Look how beautiful our golf course is, right? And not only do they show it to you on television, they let you come and they don't even really charge you a bunch of money. Like, people always talk about, like, wow, at the Masters, you can still get a sandwich for $1.50. Isn't that cool, right? And it is cool. It's kind of nifty. It's also flex. They're not even asking you to come to the tournament so they can make money off of you. They're asking you to come to the tournament to let you know how they live, let you see it, and let you feel like you can get close to it. You can get close enough to see it, but never close enough to, like, really touch it, right? Like, they are showing this to us all the time. And look, all the history of Augusta and everything else about representation and all that stuff, all of those points are perfectly fair. I am telling you, though, like, as an event, it is the most immaculately run event anywhere. They got the best app in the game, and they were ahead of the game on the apps. Like, their technology, stronger than anybody else's. Their camera shots and everything else, stronger than anybody else's. I was reading something. They did an article in 2015 about this, and they were like, if the Masters wanted to, they could charge $100, put the Masters on pay-per-view. They could probably get $300 million by doing that. 3 million people would pay for the Masters, $100, to watch it on the weekend if you gave them all the digital access and everything else. They could make $300 million off that. They're not even doing it. They're not even really trying to make money off this tournament because they all so damn rich. Like, as it stands, they're not even trying to make money off of us. They are just like, watch our perfect golf tournament. That's what we're here for. Watch our perfect golf tournament that we will make you want to be this. And you'll never, ever be this. You never will. But, like, they don't sell Masters gear on the website. Like, the only way you can get Masters gear is to go there. You got to get it from the pro shop. To get tickets, it's a lottery. They're not even beating you overhead in order to get the tickets. None of that. They're that rich. Right? Most rich people flex on you by taking your money. That is not what they do. Right? And I'm not saying this, you're trying to imply that they are like some great people or something like that, or look how cool they are. It's just amazing. Like, I don't know if you remember this, but I guess it's about 15 years ago. This woman named Martha Burke, I forget which organization she ran, but she ran a women's advocacy group. And she was trying to push Augusta National to admit its first female member, right? And of course, ain't nobody telling Augusta what to do, right? But that's what they wanted. They wanted a female member. So now we start looking at them getting in sponsors' faces, right? Flexing on them, being like, yo, you know, we're going to do some boycotts and all of this. Do you know what Augusta did? Augusta called the sponsors and said, you can sit this one out, boys. We'll take care of it. And paid for the time.
I didn't remember that. I was going to say when you mentioned like, oh, we don't know who the guest list is at Augusta. I was going to say, well, we know one is Condoleezza Rice.
Yes,
right?
Yes, that's one we know. The two I feel like we know are Condoleezza Rice and I believe Jack Nicklaus is the only Masters champion who has become a member. Think about that for a second. They only decided that one of y'all is good enough to join the crew. Only one of y'all good enough to join the crew. You know, South Carolina in football, I didn't know this until yesterday because I got into a little kerfuffle with the Kakalakians. You know, back-to-back, South Carolina hired Lou Holtz and Steve Spurrier. Hootie Johnson, who used to be the chairman of Augusta National, South Carolina grad. Because I was like, how in the world did y'all pull this off? Right? Like, those two guys are a little bit too much. Like, how did you do that? They had the chairman of Augusta National. That's how they pulled that off.
It runs so deep, man.
Yeah.
Everything in college sports runs so deep, so political, and like, you have no idea.
I don't know how people don't enjoy it more just on the face of like those sorts of things, right? But that's what the Masters is at every turn. And the way that they get us to not talk about any of the other stuff is excellence, just pure excellence. This is what we're going to give you is excellence. I also want to tell you something funny. One thing that's interesting about like Tiger Woods and the Masters and everything else is you always have some people who drop in on the Masters who don't really like watch golf like that. No judgment to them for not really watching golf, but it happens. But my best friend from growing up hit me up and was like, yo, man, I'm not comfortable with Tiger Woods putting the jacket on the new winner. Why he got to do that? And I was like, well, the defending champion puts the jacket on. And he's like, he ain't won in several years. I was like, no. I remember he won last year. He's like, damn, 2020 been so long that I forgot that last year Tiger Woods won the Masters, right? That's how long 2020 was. But he thought that they had turned Tiger Woods into Benson. Like, he was hot. Hot, I tell you, hot.
But you know what? That's how it is with like a lot of these kind of like old norms. When you think about it, that's problematic. I mean, like there are with a lot of things in society, but it hits different that a golf course that didn't allow people of color or didn't allow women for forever has that sort of action as like putting the jacket on the previous winner. And it just so happens that last year was Tiger Woods.
Yeah.
Like Johnson of all people.
Yeah, right? It all trips over. This has always been my one problem with the Masters though. If there's one thing I got to get on them about is you got to have like a little humility about yourself, right? Like some humility. And when I say that they got to have some humility about themselves, not once, not a single time did they pay tribute to the best thing that ever happened to Augusta, Georgia. You know what that is? James Brown. There ain't no statue on the course of James Brown.
James Brown's from Augusta?
Yeah. Well, I don't know if he's from. He lived there at the very least. But James Brown is readily associated with Augusta. And not once, you claim that you are the best of America. And James Brown is not a member. That's where I got beef with Augusta. I can't think of anybody they could possibly have in there who is more worthy of membership in something in America like that than James Brown. He voted for the same people y'all voted for, and not a single person at Augusta National did anything as important as Papa got a brand new bag.
Was it because he left Augusta off that list of cities he was naming in that video clip that Roy Wood posted?
Yeah, but see, this is the thing about James is, I bet in old James probably shouted out Augusta. Like back in the day, James would shout out the Chitlin Circuit places in his music. Then James got big and he started talking about actual cities because he was playing shows in different places at that point. If Augusta National couldn't do nothing for JB, then Augusta National can't only do but so much for me. I'd be talking that noise until I turn on that TV and see that lush greenery in high definition. Because that was the other thing, too. HD changed the game on the Masters. Masters is gorgeous. Gorgeous in HD. Gorgeous. It totally flipped the game up. But no, that you want to see flex. Flex is Augusta National. And let me tell you now what that flex did /for us. Gabe, did you see that mediocre slate of football we had this weekend? Oh, my God. Like, well, I looked at this, like the schedules of what was being played, and I was like, yo, these games are booty. Like, all around booty. There were five games that were on early, and I was like, yo, all I see is booty. Ugh, it was so, and of course, on TV here, they gave us the Giants and the Eagles. I'm like, bump that. I got to get on the app. The best thing on the app was I was checking in on our man, Aqib Talib, first game of color commentary. There's room for improvement, but I thought he was pretty good. He seems to really enjoy watching football. That was the biggest thing I got out of it.
I feel like lots of people, at least like football nerdy type people,
yeah,
watch the game on mute.
Yeah, I think there's something to that.
If you're going to have an announcer, don't you want it to be someone that is going to like give you a reason to not mute it, right?
Yes, yes. I did get the feeling that he had not prepped as much as he probably should have. Like, he's like, I played football for a million years. You know what I mean? I could do this. And I did think it would take like a couple replays and he'd be like, oh, okay, cool. They were in two man, you know, and then go back from there, right? Like, I did notice that element, but that was legit. In the early slate, that was about the best thing that anybody had going. Like, I mean, all the games. Like, it was the Eagles and the Giants. It was the Browns and the Texans. And that game had the nerve to get delayed. It was the Packers and the Jaguars. And it was the Bucks and the Panthers. And let me tell you something right fast. It all worked out in the end for me. But shout out to everybody else that's like me that finally got Nick Chubb off the fantasy football injured reserve, only to have him run out of bounds before getting them 6 points that could have helped you out in your fantasy game. And I looked at it. It was like a minute left in the game, right? And so they had decided they were up by three, and they had decided they were just going to go, like, not score a touchdown, run out the clock. Y'all would have been up by 10 points. Y'all don't think y'all could hold a 10-point lead in a minute? Are you serious? Like, you out here messing with our lives and our pockets? Because some of y'all, I know it affected y'all's pockets. Y'all out here messing with people like that? Y'all don't think that y'all could hold a 10-point lead for a minute? Are you serious? Anyway, the afternoon games were interesting. I don't know how much, Gabe, you saw of the Josh Allen, Kyler Murray game. Man, this Josh Allen thing. I got to say this, man. I need y'all to grow up a little bit so that we can actually have Josh Allen discussions. Gabe, we've talked about this on here before. People think I dislike Josh Allen. Why? Right? Like, I don't know the dude. He's not said anything that I find to be objectionable. I've had people assume that I don't like Josh Allen because apparently he sent some tweets in his teenage years that indicated some level of racial animus. But if you've ever listened to me before, you know I don't do that.
So here's the thing with Josh Allen, though. On the podcast, it's nothing but praise for Josh Allen. What is going on television that leads people to believe that you are some anti-Josh Allen guy? Because it's so interesting because you get like this negative reaction and you end up on the podcast. You know, this is almost like your therapy session. What have I done to anger these Josh Allen defenders? What have I done? And I haven't seen the other side of this.
But here's what I say on Twitter. When he throws an interception that looks horrible, I say he threw a horrible interception. When he does something that is brain dead, I say he did something that was brain dead. But when he makes the throw to Stephon Diggs in the corner to take the lead against the Cardinals, I say that's the best throw of his career, right? Like, when he does good things, I say that he does good things. He's gotten better than I ever thought he would be. Like, the same thing happened with Kirk Cousins, right? And the truth is, the problem is this comes to race, right? People are operating on this assumption that I don't like the overrated white dude. Now, I don't like people overrating the white dude, but I got no beef with the dude himself. I got no distaste for Josh Allen. Josh Allen ain't done nothing to me, and it is a fun watch. Don't get me wrong. But holy shit, man, y'all don't be paying no attention. That dude tried to throw two interceptions to Patrick Peterson, and Peterson didn't bring him in. Then he did throw two other interceptions, right? Like, those things do, in fact, happen. They do, in fact, count. And what Josh Allen is a trick-or-treat quarterback. He's going to hit you with some treats, but it's about to be some tricks. Like, this is what it's going to be. But that game was a great, great, great watch by the end. Because Allen, again, he is like Kirk Cousins in the sense that he is better than I ever thought that he would be, right? Even if I don't think he's as good as some of these other people do, y'all just go too far, right? What about Josh Allen for MVP? No, not at all. Like, that's ridiculous. What are you talking about? Have you heard of Patrick Mahomes? Like, are you high? No, he's not Josh Allen for MVP. It's Josh Allen for contract extension. That should be good enough, right? Like, that should make you guys happy. But he got that throw off the Diggs. That was cash money. Kyler Murray then came back on the other end, and that throw was one of the most incredible throws that you'll ever see. The catch from Hopkins was one of the most amazing catches that you will ever see, right? This dude is 5'9", rolling left, and gets his body in position to make a perfect throw into the end zone from 50 yards out. He had enough time, just enough time to turn his shoulders around and get that torque and then whip it down there. And then Hopkins, dude, Deshaun Watson had to be watching that like, look at this. He on the team playing riding home. It was wild with the Texans is they are loaded at receiver. By the way, did you see that clip a couple weeks ago of DeAndre Hopkins riding down the freeway in Phoenix in his Ferrari? This is all I'm saying about DeAndre Hopkins. That dude from South Carolina, and it has affected him. Like, this is the dude with Denmark Vesey's name on his helmet, you know, as the victims of racism. I thought this was a big thing where I haven't cared that much about, like, the jerseys and the slogans and stuff like that. Those haven't really gone too far. But Hopkins figured out the way to really use it, which is white folks is a lot more comfortable talking about, like, historical racism than contemporary racism. Contemporary racism, that comes a little bit too close, right? That's a brushback pitch. Historical racism, they're like, oh, okay, that ain't gonna hit me. That'll be okay. And so the Cardinals, I think it was when they played, it may have been the Cowboys, I can't remember who, but Hopkins had Vesey's name on the back of his helmet. And next thing you know, especially it's a blowout, they go down to the field to Lisa Salters, and now she's telling the story of Denmark Vesey on an NFL broadcast. That's huge, right? Like, that's, I actually think, bigger than bringing attention to any of these current things, because that's more likely to make people raise the question of, why is it that we do not treat a man like this as a hero? Hopkins has won all the points in the world for me this year. And then Kyler Murray looks great, right? He started us off a little bit slow. I can't believe how good that he's turned out to be. Kingsbury, who I still don't think they should have hired as coach necessarily. I think he should have been the offensive coordinator, but it's working. Like, I was at least glad that we got that by the end of the day. Because otherwise, man, we wasn't getting nothing. I tried to watch that Patriots-Ravens game. That one there was a bit of a struggle. Oh, and Jameis back. Drew Brees got 5 broken ribs. Ouch. How long would you be off of your current job as I look at you right now on your couch with a pillow behind your head? How long would it take you to come back to work if you had 5 broken ribs and a collapsed lung? I would have retired on the spot. I would have recovered from these cracked ribs, and the next time you would have saw me, I'd have had a suit and a hairpiece, and I'd have been on Sunday Night Football.
It would be a couple months before I'd be back in the game.
That sounds so painful. That sounds so painful, right? And let me tell you what my homeboy said about Taysom Hill. He made a great point. Taysom Hill's not going to be playing quarterback for the Saints in all likelihood. It'll probably be Jameis. And my man's like, how you going to tell me that Taysom Hill is so important, but he can't play quarterback, which is the most important position on the field? All right, and we are back with Baseline. We are doing our series again this year. This time, we are doing it on the Prep to Pro pipeline in basketball. First installment of this, we had Dan Wetzel of Yahoo Sports. This week, we are going to talk to Brian Windhorst of ESPN, talk to him about the NBA's role in the Prep to Pro pipeline, and also what's going on with the G League. Now, Brian, we're like really 25 years now into the era of high school players going to the NBA really as quickly as they possibly can. Now they're taking a stop off year with the NCAA. So in the league now, like, we hear a lot about, you know, waiting for the end to come on this one and done situation in college. But how soon do we think the NBA is going to start taking high school players?
Not soon at all. Because the reality is that this is something that the Players Association has limited really interest in doing this, because there's going to be 60 players drafted every year, whether they're 28 or whether they're 18. It doesn't make a difference. So there's going to be 60 new jobs per year. And the Players Association ultimately does not represent kids coming from high school. They represent them when they come into the NBA. So the only way this is going to happen is if the Players Association can get this without having to trade something else up. And one of the big things that's been happening in recent negotiations is the NBA teams want more medical information on players. And they want to be able to do all kinds of testing, whether it's blood testing or diagnostic testing. And they're saying, well, if we're taking a kid at 18 and we don't get to see him go through college, we want to do even more medical testing. And the union's like, the hell you are. And so basically that's where we're at right now. There's loggerheads that the union isn't willing to give up, you know, trade anything for, you know, getting this age limit removed. And they are absolutely not willing to cross the Rubicon on some of that testing because they feel it's a way in. You know, the idea here would be, Bomani, you do a blood test or you get on some special you know, thing that looks at you, the gait of your feet, and they go up. He's got a 13.6% greater chance of blowing his ACL, so he's not drafted. You know, you go disqualified by that. They're not down with that. So I would say that we are not close to having that lifted right now.
Now, that's interesting because I think it was the 2022 draft that people were looking at for this, is that being like the double draft, right? The one that would have high school players and the first year players from the year before. And it seemed like a lot of personnel moves were being made with that in mind. But it sounds like from what you're saying that the teams are now looking at that like, okay, never mind.
That's definitely not happening by 22. There's so many more things to negotiate, and it's just not that high of a priority. The other thing is the NBA is developing this. Well, I mean, their nice little beautiful term for it is the professional pathway. They're developing this special G League team. And quite frankly, that's a potential new revenue source for them. So why? And they're basically honing in on colleges. They're trying to take some of the colleges' corner, and that could be profitable. And it may not make sense for the NBA to get rid of that. And the thing, here's the real reality. If you go back and look at the 50 or so players who were taken out of high school, yes, there are a couple that were amazing right off the bat. Kevin Durant, LeBron James, Kobe Bryant. But the majority of those guys were not ready. So yeah, Zion Williamson was ready probably to come straight out of high school to the NBA. But that is the 1% of the 1%. And so I still don't think that it's a viable pathway for a lot of people. And I think the NBA has found and is establishing this new path that may actually end up working out more from a business standpoint and reduce the push to make it age 18.
Well, also, you were covering the NBA in the era where guys were coming straight from high school. And let us just say that that was a little bit of a different era of the NBA. And one thing the league learned, it felt to me, and you tell me if I'm wrong here, it's a lot to ask an 18, 19-year-old to jump in and be an NBA player after not leaving home or prep school prior to then.
Yeah, if I read you the list of I think there's 44 guys that were taken, you would see that most of them were busts. You know, Corleone Young was sort of the poster child of the bust. He was big time player coming out and played like 15 minutes in the NBA. But if I told you guys like Leon Smith,
right,
Ricky Sanchez, Robert Swift, Sagana Jopp, Jonathan Bender, Bill Willoughby, guys like Kendrick Perkins and Deshaun Stevenson, Amir Johnson, who's now on that Ignite team. These are guys that you would say were success stories. You know, guys like Martell Webster, Travis Outlaw. These were success stories. You know, and then all kinds of busts like, you know, Sebastian Telfair. There's just not that many positive stories where it really worked out for stars. And even the guys who made it arguably would have been better had they gone to school. You know, well, you know, what sort of career could some of these guys have had they gone to school? So there are some, you know, Jermaine O'Neal, Rashard Lewis had a great career. Amari Stoudemire, obviously T-Mac, Dwight Howard, KG, obviously Kobe, LeBron. But there's a lot more dudes who didn't make it. So the NBA is not only trying to reduce that, but they're also trying to protect those players a little bit. And so those are the guys who got drafted, Bomani. There was dozens of guys who declared and then didn't get drafted. The Lenny Cooks of the world,
right,
if anybody remembers that story. While this is a weird situation for that super upper echelon, I think overall, I don't think the NBA is completely unhappy with the way things have gone.
Yeah, and Jermaine O'Neal was interesting because he was one of the rare guys of that run where there was time for him to develop. Like, he spent 2 or 3 years in Portland where they weren't asking very much of him. And so many of these other guys just kind of get, you know, thrown. Like, LeBron James had broader shoulders than anybody that we could think of when it comes to handling this. But I still wonder, he had a very successful career ultimately, but J.R. Smith was supposed to go to North Carolina. And I've just always wondered what would have happened if he did not immediately go from home to the NBA in 2004.
Right. And it took J.R., you know, a couple of teams gave up on him before J.R., you know, really got his feet up underneath him. But I think ultimately the balance is protecting the player versus protecting the team. The NBA isn't necessarily doing this because they feel like, oh, let's make sure that we take care of these poor 18-year-old kids. I mean, I think they care about them once they get in the league. A lot of this is they're protecting the teams from making draft picks that set them back. And you have to be honest with yourself that that's a factor in all this.
Now, does the NBA feel as though the NCAA and the college game does a good job of developing players?
Yeah, I think it's mostly been a really positive system because the college game helps build these guys up. You know, even with the high school coverage that we now have in the NBA, we can watch top NBA guys play on ESPN occasionally. Generally, they become household names in college. And so the NBA not only gets a development year or couple of years, but they get those guys from a marketing standpoint to be marketed so that when they come into the NBA, millions of people know who they are. That is a positive thing. Plus, there's going to be dozens and dozens and dozens of guys who don't make it, who the colleges weed out for you. You know, that's one thing. You know, the NBA for a few years, Bomani, looked into creating these academies where they would actually take kids in high school. They are doing this in other parts of the world. They were doing it in China. That has been shut down a little bit. They were doing it in Australia. They've done it in Africa. They've got some success stories coming out of Africa where they actually take these kids, put them in a dorm, and educate them, or they educate them in coalition with an established school, basically a bunch of Oak Hill academies across the world. Well, the NBA looked into this and said, could we start one or two like in Dallas or Las Vegas where we could basically get these kids like they do with soccer? This is very popular and been very successful with soccer and basketball to a certain extent, but really with soccer in Europe. And in fact, some of these academies in Europe, Ajax, which is very well known in Holland, it's a huge profit center. They find these kids when they're 8 years old, hold them for 7 or 8 years, train them, educate them, and they sell them for sometimes millions of dollars to these big time teams, you know, Barcelona or Manchester City or whoever. And that's the development system. Not only do these major teams in Europe have their own academies where they're finding, you know, kids before they're teenagers and developing them in theory to their parent teams, there's academies that will do the development for them that they can buy the players out of. Almost like if the New York Knicks wrote Duke a check for whichever prospect they had developed and brought them to the NBA. That's essentially how it works. And so the NBA looked at that and said, well, let's not have the teams actually do it. Let's do it as a league. And they reached the conclusion that, especially in the United States, they didn't want the burden of having to educate and discipline all these kids. So they, after investigating it for a period of time, decided to put that on the back burner. But they did create this G League team, which they have called the Ignite, which is starting this upcoming season. And they have basically stolen a layer of elite college basketball prospects. They're going to play there for a year. They're going to coach them up. They're going to educate them on what it is to be a professional player. And they're going to pay them, in some cases, a lot of money. Jalen Green being the poster child for this particular program, he's getting $500,000. They do not have to take buses around the country, like other G League teams do, or you know, squeeze into coach seats flying between Sioux Falls and Fort Wayne. They will play most of their games, and they're not going to play that many, in a beautiful area in California. And they are given professional coaches. Brian Shaw has been hired to coach the team, former NBA coaches. And what I think that they hope that this will do is that all of these people who, you know, that there's a new product to sell, basically, that in addition to watching college, in addition to watching the NBA, they will create this niche product and they will create their own little one-year academy, which will help the NBA, but also, you know, again, create something to sell. And that is the product of them studying what's happened in Europe with soccer, studying their academies overseas. And that's where they are. And they are really going forward with it. And I would say it's one of the biggest things Adam Silver has done as commissioner.
Now, who would the team play against?
They're going to play against some other G League teams. So they're going to play against some men who will come in there. There's also a possibility that they could play against some college teams. They also could bring over the NBA a couple of times a year, brings over their best international prospects in this particular COVID era. I doubt it's going to be happening this year, but several times a year, they bring their best prospects from overseas over to play in the United States in front of all the scouts. They could play those teams. But generally, Bomani, it's going to be a light schedule. They may only play a few dozen games. They will practice and they're hanging out, and they're living in Walnut Creek, California, which is a very affluent East Bay suburb. I have not seen their facilities, but I'm sure they're quite nice. And they will not have the rigors of even a college season. They're not going to have to go to Lawrence, Kansas on Tuesday night and Stillwater on Saturday. They will mostly be able to be sort of sheltered and very, very comfortable. And, the two places they were also looking at putting them in LA. So you spend 9 months being basically given a very comfortable NBA education without having to worry about school, without having to worry about sneaking around to take money from people. You get an actual paycheck that's legitimate salary. And, you know, it wouldn't surprise me that this becomes the new Team USA in terms of team building, where star players get in their fifth and sixth year. And, oh, yeah, they played on the G League Ignite together. Of course, they're going to want to team up. This has a chance, if done right, to be the new super team incubator.
Now, does the NBA view college basketball as a legitimate competitor? Because then you talk about them kind of moving on their corner, but it's, you know, college basketball has done good things for the NBA by doing all this stuff for free.
Yeah, I think they are moving on it primarily because college basketball has become preposterously corrupt, and the changes that have been requested are mostly being ignored. And, you know, it's just preposterous that a player can't take advantage of his name and likeness. And I know that they're at a snail's pace bringing this in. And part of the reason why they're going to have to do it is because the NBA is initiating this program. On this G League Ignite team, five of ESPN's top 100 prospects have committed to it. Instead of being at North Carolina, Duke, Kansas, wherever this season, they are at this. And who's to say, if it doesn't go well, that in 3 or 4 years they could have two teams, and now you have 12 or 15 of the top 100 prospects doing it, and they start playing each other a lot. Next thing you know, they start playing each other, and Amazon wants to buy the rights, or maybe ESPN wants to buy the rights. Now it's a whole other, like, sort of in between college and NBA, where it's a whole nother product. Now, do I think that Duke, North Carolina great games are going anywhere? No, they are not. But if this is viewed as a comfortable way, and the guys are successful, and they can make $500,000, or maybe in 5 years, it's $1 million, and they don't have to, you know, beg, borrow, plead, and contort themselves into some preposterous, you know, name and likeness thing where they can maybe make, you know, $55,000 if they're given the blessing from Indianapolis. This could be just something that works around it. I mean, I think that the exploitive college system is laughable. And when I see rumors of a guy getting $100,000 here or $50,000 there, I'm like, good. This is a way to do it where they can actually, you know, get rewarded for it without having to do this. And the NCAA is moving so slow and so conservative on this. The NBA sees a lane and they are trying to take it. I can't predict whether it'll be successful, but they are seriously investing in it. Even in this time where the NBA is experiencing some financial pressures that they haven't experienced in a long time, they're pouring money into this G League Ignite program.
It's also interesting, like, this seems to be the first generation of kids that just does not dream of playing college basketball at all. Like, it doesn't seem like the idea of playing college basketball doesn't seem to be something that this generation of kids really cares that much about. They're trying to get to the NBA as quickly as possible.
I think that's fair. I think the value judgment is off. I think they would like to play college basketball and like to play in the NCAA tournament, but they would also like to take care of their families.
Right.
And not have to, you know, take their AAU coach's uncles, you know, getting, you know, Venmo'd some money from some booster. I think they would like to make it clean. So ideally, you could have your money and play in college. But if this is the way it's got to go, I think the kids today are way more savvy. Like, I'm not saying you're going to see a whole bunch of more Ball families out there, but no matter what you want to say about LeVar Ball, and you can argue about whether or not he botched an opportunity, he had a vision of getting his kids taken care of that is only going to grow with where we are right now in amateur sports.
And I also think we're seeing, at least it feels a bit more, and he's not the first to do this, but like Gary Trent Jr. is a great example of a guy that came in as like a top 10 recruit, had no plans of playing a sophomore year in college. And he was a second round pick, which had to be disappointing. And he knew he was going to be a second round pick when he came out, but would still rather be a second round pick and maybe get a two-way deal, you know, go to the G League and come up than keep doing this in college for free.
Right, and LaMelo just ended up playing in Australia, which I think was a positive experience for him. But why go to Australia or China, or you know Brandon Jennings, you know, went to Italy, which I'm sure was lovely. But why go all around the world when you can hang in Walnut Creek, or you know, maybe if there's a second team, it's in Marina Del Rey. You know, I mean, would you rather go to Australia to make a couple hundred thousand, or would you rather make 500,000 playing 25 games in, you know, based out of Marina Del Rey for 9 months? And, you know, I think that is going to be a very comfortable option for guys if this works. In the NBA, like, whether or not Jalen Green becomes a star player or not, I don't know. But the deal that he was able to drive, where he not only can get shoe endorsement money, but was able to get $500,000 to play in this environment that is going to be collegial in so many ways, it was a heck of a deal that he got. And I think he could end up being really a pioneer for how this could go.
Yeah. And I think one thing people are losing sight of now, and it's like, makes sense, but there are more good players now than there have ever been, to a point where you can get a Giannis with the 13th pick in the draft. You can get Kawhi Leonard with the 15th pick in the draft. Like, stars seem to be everywhere. So it feels like there's going to be more options for different ways for guys to do this, because there are more guys that can get in and more paths that I think fit players in different ways.
Also, the teams love this idea that they can have access to go watch these guys. Like, you can go watch the, you know, you're going to have all kinds of information on these players. You're going to have, you know, the NBA is going to capture information. So while they would prefer to take their blood and MRI every square centimeter of their body and all this stuff, and, you know, have them stand on these plates and, you know, all these things and measurements, they are going to have access that they wouldn't have normally had. So the NBA teams like it because they can make better draft decisions. I mean, the draft, even with the information that they have now with the colleges, the draft is still so much of a crapshoot, especially we're talking about 19-year-olds, that these players will be given NBA training and NBA preparation. Whether or not they adhere to that is another story. This is something that the teams like too, because it won't require you to go out there and beat the bushes and find Giannis in Greece and stash him in your house and stuff like that, that you will be able to have a more free market, a more even playing field when identifying these guys.
All right, that is Brian Windhorst. Be sure to keep checking us out here on the Baseline Series. We're going to have Jonathan Givony join us in a couple of weeks, Myron Metcalf, both of ESPN, to join us to talk about the Prep to Pro pipeline in the NBA. Man, thank you so much. I appreciate it.
Thank you, sir.
And ladies and gentlemen, thanks so much for joining us here on The Right Time. We do this thing a couple times a week. Gabe Bassin, Tarika Foster, Christina Buswell handled everything behind the scenes. Thank you, guys. Also, thank you to our guests. Remember, subscribe to The Right Time. Rate us, review us, give us 5 stars. You only give us 4 stars. I'm inclined to believe you are a hater. And we'll talk to you guys in a couple of days. Take it easy.
Thanks for checking out The Right Time with Bomani Jones Podcast.
You can listen or subscribe on the ESPN app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to podcasts.
The Right Time
with Bomani Jones.